Sunday of Nenwold Fair, my Uncle Silas came to visit us. He was a man sometimes of strict habits. He wound up his watch after every meal, never let a day pass without a bottle of wine, and never stirred out without his gallstone. A lump of barbaric rock as large as a pheasant's egg, treasured as the relic of an operation at the early age of 70. Carefully wrapped up in a piece of his housekeeper's calico and reverently laid away in the bum pocket of his breeches. From my Uncle Silas's house to my grandmother's, it was less than 7 miles, an hour's journey. But somehow, at Shouldrop, the horse was tired, or my Uncle Silas was tired, and he knew the widow who kept the bell there, and it seemed a shame to go past the door of the pub itself without going in to take and give a little comfort. And whether it was the giving or the taking of the comfort or what, we never knew. But it was nearly 11 o'clock by the time my Uncle Silas drove on to Notting Fox, where he knew the landlord of the George very well, and the barmaid better. From Notting Fox to Yeldon, it was less than 3 miles, and at Yeldon, my Uncle Silas had a distant relation, a big pink sow of a publican, who had married a second wife as neat as a silk purse. And at Yeldon, he'd no sooner seen the bottom in a quart twice than it was dinner time. At last, he drove on to Bromswold, still out of his course, to sit in the bar of the Swan there, all afternoon, reverently unwrapping his gallstone and wrapping it up again, for whoever was there to see.
"Feel on it, man. Go on. Feel the weight on it. That's a tiny weight, you know. Used to be bigger, me boy-o, bigger. Used to be bigger than a duck's egg. What do you think of that? Think of having that inside you, eh?"
All the time, at my grandmother's, we were waiting for him, eating first dinner and then tea without him. But finally, towards dusk, my Uncle Silas would arrive, lit up. His hat on the back of his head, his face as red as a laying hen's, his necktie undone, a pink aster as big as a saucer in his buttonhole, his voice bawling like a bull's to the horse.
"Whoa, damn you, stand still, George, hold this damn nag still a minute, I want to get out. Whoa, stop him."
"He's been a-standing still about 5 minutes, Silas."
At last my Uncle Silas would alight, waddling across the farmyard on his half-bandy legs like a man on a ship, in gentle staggers of uncertainty, bawling at the top of his devilish voice,
"And now we're here, we are here. Whoops! Steady! Lost the leg of my drawers."
Finally, we would sit down to supper, the big dining table and the many little tables crowded with relatives, my grandfather carving the ham and beef, my Uncle Silas staggering round the table and then from one table to another with bottles of cowslip wine, totting it half over the tablecloth, giving an extra stagger of devilry against the ladies, and taking no notice even of my grandmother's tartest reprimands.
"I've said it before, and I shall say it again. You shall not come here, Silas, if you can't behave yourself."
And one year, as we sat there eating in the summer half-darkness, the room rich with the smell of ham and beer and the wine my Uncle Silas had spilled everywhere he went, my grandfather, for some reason, got up and went out, and in less than 5 minutes was back again, with a scared look on his face.
"Silas?" he said. "Summat's happened. The pig's out."
"Not the sow, George. The sow ain't out."
"Busted the door down. How the Hanover—"
"Let me get up. God almighty, let me get up."
Somehow my Uncle Silas staggered to his feet. My grandfather and he were men of utterly opposite character. My grandfather as mild as a heifer, Silas as wild as a young colt. But where pigs were concerned, they were equal men. Pigs brought out in them the same tender qualities. They gazed in mutual meditation over sty rails. They suffered from the same outrage and melancholy when their litters failed or their sows were sick. A sow was sacred to them. Litters were lovelier than babies. And my Uncle Silas staggered up as though he were choking.
"Oh, God, let me get out! Let me get out!"
He pushed back his chair, lurched against the table, made an immense effort to right himself, somehow managed to stagger to the door, and then bawled,
"George, boy, she ain't in pig."
"Yes."
We heard the faint voice far across the farmyard in answer. "My God!" The next moment we heard my Uncle Silas slither down all five stone steps of the back door, blaspheming at every step, and blaspheming even more as he sat on his backside in the hen-mucked yard outside. When I arrived on the threshold, Silas was still sitting in the yard. He seemed to be trying to straighten his legs. He kept taking hold first of one leg, then another. One minute they were crossed, and he was trying to uncross them. A minute later they were uncrossed, and he seemed to be trying to cross them again. He saw me coming down the steps.
"Get me up, God Almighty! My legs are tangled like a lot of wool. Get me up!"
Somehow I managed to get him to his feet as the sow came blundering across the yard. There was something pathetic about her. She was like a creature in anguish. She was snorting and grunting and slobbering with distress, and as my Uncle Silas advanced to meet her, he spread out his arms, as though in tender readiness, to embrace her.
"Good gal, good gal, come on now, dig, dig, good gal, wool now."
Suddenly she saw him, but it was as though she had not seen him. She simply lifted her head and kept straight on. My Uncle Silas, too, kept straight on, muttering all the time in his thick, tender voice, and she snorting and slobbering in the gentle anguish of her predicament. All at once, my Uncle Silas stopped, but the sow kept straight on. She seemed, if anything, to increase her pace, and suddenly my Uncle Silas let out a curious yell of blasphemous astonishment and threw up his hands. The next moment, the sow hit him. She caught him full between the legs, and she went on after she had struck him, so that momentarily my Uncle Silas was lifted up. For another moment he seemed to ride on the sow's head, backwards, his squat bow legs flapping like the ears of the sow herself. Then the sow threw him. She gave a sort of nodding toss of her head, as a horse does to a fly, my Uncle Silas falling flat on his back in the yard again, his legs waving, his arms clawing wildly at the sow as she stampeded over and past him, her great teats flapping his face and half-smothering his roars of blasphemous rage. Then something happened. The sow stopped. She seemed to stagger, as Silas himself had done, as though her legs were tangled among themselves. And with my Uncle Silas bawling at the top of his voice, she gave a sudden sigh and sank on her side.
"George, boy, I'm got her! I'm got her, George, boy, I'm got her!
Hold her, hold her!
I am holding her! She's atop on me!
Hold her, for God's sake, hold her!"
My grandfather came running across the yard, and all the men and half the women out of the house. I ran up too. My Uncle Silas had his arms round the sow's neck. They were locked in embrace. The sow herself was lying over his chest, a great belly flattened out softly over one of his legs, her teats distended as though she were about to give suck to a litter. There was a look of perfect beatitude on my Uncle Silas's face as he lay there with the pig in his arms, a look of pure, intoxicated content.
"Good girl, Tig, I got a George boy. Tig, Tig, good girl."
"Now, Silas..."
My grandfather and four men bent over the sow, seizing her great carcass, in readiness to upheave her.
"When we left her, you let her go."
"I'm got her, George, boy. I'm got her."
"You let go when we left, Silas. Silas, let go. Dallit, how can we lift her up if you don't let her go?"
"You wanted me to get her, and I'm got her. That's all right, ain't it?"
"Yes, Silas, yes, but we can't get her up if you don't let her go."
"She's all right, let her alone. Good old girl, Tig, Tig."
"Let go, Silas, let go."
At that moment, my grandmother came up. She was a small, tart, wiry woman, like a bird. Her words were like swift pecks at Silas.
"Silas, get up, get up. Silas, I will not have it, get up." "He won't let go,"
my grandfather said.
"Every time we try to pull the sow off him, he won't let go." "Oh, won't he?"
She suddenly seized hold of Silas by the head, just under the neck. From that moment, my Uncle Silas lost some of his gaiety and content.
"Tilly, what are you doing on? Let us alone, Tilly and me old..."
If we can't pull the sow off him, we'll pull him off the sow. Get hold of him.
Oh, it's all right, Tilly. I'm gonna. Let me go bed with you. Oh, I want to go bed with her. I want to...
I'd be ashamed of myself, Silas. Stand up.
Suddenly, my grandmother heaved him by the neck, and the men heaved too. The sow gave a grunt and a struggle as my Uncle Silas was heaved from beneath her. And in another moment, both he and the sow were jerked to their feet, her great teats swinging free, and the back buttons of my Uncle Silas's trousers bursting off at the same time like crackers.
By God, that's done it! Hold 'em up, Silas!
My Uncle Silas gave a single wild swagger, his trousers falling down, concertina fashion, before the men caught him and lifted him up and carried him off into the house, his legs windmilling, his wicked, devilish voice bawling all over the farmyard above the voices of the shrieking ladies.
Let 'em all come!
It was the last I saw of him that night. In the morning, when I came downstairs, the guests had gone. My grandfather was in the fields, and there was no one about except my grandmother, who sat in the chair by the kitchen window, sewing the buttons on the back of a pair of tweed breeches. After breakfast, I took the breeches upstairs. I knocked at my Uncle Silas's door, but no one answered. Then I knocked again, but nothing happened. And finally, I opened the door a crack and looked in. "Your breeches," I said. My Uncle Silas lay submerged by the bedclothes. I could see nothing of him but his mouse-coloured hair and a single bleary, bloodshot eye which squinted over the coverlet at me.
"I?"
"Your breeches." After that one utterance, he was silent. It was indeed all I ever heard him say of his behaviour with the sow. Except once, when I reminded him of it over a glass of wine, and then he said,
"What sow? When were that?"
"You remember," I said. And I told him about it again, laughing as I spoke, telling him how he'd caught the sow and held her down, and then how the buttons of his breeches had snapped off as we strained to release him. "You must have been some buttons short that night," I said. "Don't you remember?" He sat silent for a minute, his glass empty in his hand, his lips wet and shining with wine, looking at me with the blandest cocking of his bloodshot eye in an innocent effort of recollection. At last he shook his head.
"No," he said. "There's some things you can't remember."
His hand was on the bottle.
"Mouthful of wine?"